Welcome to Oncology Today, optimizing the management of metastatic BRCA-negative, triple-negative breast cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Professor Peter Schmid from the Barts Cancer Institute in London. In addition to this interview, there's also a corresponding video program featuring Professor Schmidt's slide presentation. To begin, I asked him to discuss the immunogenicity and potential response to checkpoint inhibitors that's seen in breast cancer compared to other solid tumors.
Yeah, really important question. So breast cancer in general, and it's always difficult to generalize, is less immunogenic compared to, obviously, melanoma, but also lung cancer and some of the more squamous type diseases. But of course, within breast cancer, it's such a wide and heterogeneous disease. There are some subgroups that have a high tumor mutational burden, high mutational load. Triple negative breast cancer was probably the lowest hanging fruit. But we equally see a group of patients with HER2 positive breast cancer who have a high mutational instability and therefore many neoantigens. And even in luminal B cancers, in ER-positive breast cancer, we probably have many tumor antigens and could consider that. I would expect, and if you look at some of the data, the early studies, for example, in HER2-positive breast cancer, we saw actually interesting signals that were very similar to TNBC. We have seen in early ER-positive breast cancer, again, in the neoadjuvant studies, a very powerful signal for the addition of immune therapy. What is clear is the percentage of patients who may benefit from immune therapy is probably higher in TNBC compared to ER-positive breast cancer. But if you select the right patients, we need to be more proactive in breast cancer compared to other tumor types to find the right patients who may benefit from immune therapy. And that group is smaller in ER-positive breast cancer, but still a group where I would expect immune therapy to work in the future. At the moment, PD-L1 seems to be, despite all the limitations, the best marker we have to select those patients. And PD-L1 in breast cancer is very different to, for example, lung cancer. In lung cancer, in a substantial proportion of patients, PD-L1 expression is found on cancer cells. In breast cancer, most of the PD-L1 expression is actually on the immune infiltrate. And as such, there's a big overlap between PD-L1 expression and TILs. It's very difficult in breast cancer to be PD-L1 positive and not having any tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes. But obviously, it gives us a little bit more information than just TILs because it also tells us about the checkpoint status. And so we are continue to work on identifying the right patients. But at the moment, it is in TNBC, PD-L1 positive patients with whichever of the two established assays we are using. TMB is less relevant, but because it's generally much lower compared to other subtypes. But of course, in those rare patients who have a high TMB, immune therapy can be considered. And if they have TNBC, they usually are also PD-L1 positive.
You seen any MSI high breast cancer?
We do, but relatively infrequently. Similar to the tumor mutational burden, it's a small subgroup of patients, but they can be treated with immune checkpoint inhibitors per registered indication. But the experience with this in breast cancer is relatively limited at this point in time.
So another sort of global issue I was thinking about, as you were talking, was about ADCs. And I don't know if I'm like the last one to sort of get this, so to speak, but, you know, I remember when they first came out and the whole idea of, you know, the Trojan horse and that the chemo that was in there was much more stronger and more toxic. You couldn't give it systemically and that whole model. And then we started seeing trials and trials and trials. And, you know, when I take a step back, and it was only recently that I started to realize that in general, ADCs are more effective than systemic chemotherapy, not just in breast cancer. I know it seems kind of obvious, but, and also I think in general, although maybe the toxicity profile is a little bit different, that they're less toxic, you know, less need for discontinuation than systemic chemo. Do you think that broad sort of, observation holds?
So I think the first part, definitely. We ultimately can give we can give more targeted and higher doses of chemotherapy into the tumor. And that's what drives ultimately the efficacy. So it's a targeted treatment, but I would rather describe it as targeted chemotherapy. And that allows us to give more effective dose into the tumor. In terms of is toxicity higher or lower, that's a difficult question, because if you look at how these drugs were developed, we use very similar criteria to standard chemotherapy, looking for maximum tolerated doses. And therefore, the ultimate toxicity profile is relatively comparable to single-agent chemotherapy, but with a much higher efficacy at the end of the day. And what is really important for me is that it's the learning curve. And I said this twice during my talk, but I don't think we can mention it often enough. We need to learn to work with our tools as oncologists. And ADCs are new tools for us. And when you first work with ADCs, you may experience side effects, and we may not manage them as well as we could do. Now, we have several years of a learning curve now, for example, with SG or with TDXD. And I can tell you, patients who are getting this treatment today are having a much better experience than 5 or 7 years ago. And many of the side effects we used to see are much, much better managed and controlled.
Yeah, I noticed you mentioned that you feel like diarrhea is not much of a problem with sacituzumab using, I sound like you were saying, preemptive antidiarrheals, which I know was actually studied in a trial, but I am curious because I've heard other people say, oh, diarrhea is really not a problem. We don't need to treat it preemptively. Do you generally treat people preemptively, and what do you exactly do?
So one of the things that probably has helped with this is we give patients very effective antiemetic prophylaxis. And a lot of the antiemetics cause constipation. And as a result, we already reduce the incidence of diarrhea. And then we don't start prophylactically on loperamide, but patients have loperamide at home and with the first loose bowel motion start on loperamide. And as such, it doesn't really get to grade 2 or grade 3. And with those two measures, very early intervention with loperamide, but also more effective antiemetics, which have a constipation potential, we see less diarrhea these days.
That's really interesting about the antiemetics. I wasn't aware of that. Another issue with SG, and again, preemptive strategies have been looked at here, is the use of growth factors. How do you think through the issue of neutropenia with SG? Do you view patients with prior a lot of chemotherapy or prior neutropenia differently? And how do you actually prevent and manage that with SG?
So there are obviously different strategies applied in different countries and different hospitals. What I prefer doing is primary prophylaxis, and we can argue whether it needs to be a primary or whether it can be secondary. But I think in these pre-treated patients with TNBC, primary prophylaxis is certainly not wrong, and we give short acting G-CSF between day 1 and 8. And then long acting after day 8. And with that, our risk of neutropenic complication has gone down substantially. I think that's also obviously helped by the lower rate of gastrointestinal symptoms, which is often a driver for neutropenic fever. And therefore, we see very little these days.
I'm also going to bring up Dato-DXd and triple negative breast cancer. As you mentioned, it's approved now in ER positive. And there you have the choice of SG and a Dato, which I'm curious about. But sort of sticking to triple negative, first of all, any thoughts about when we're going to see first-line data with Dato and triple negative? Do you think we might see something at this upcoming ESMO?
I think the first trial so obviously there are two metastatic trials, TROPION-Breast02 and 05. 02 is probably going to read out earlier. And it will hopefully soon be in the public domain when that trial will read out. But I don't think it is far off from seeing data.
And, you know, it's interesting, too, when you look at these ADCs, at least in terms of triple negative and ER positive, it seems to be kind of leaping over that, you know, the classic subgroup. It kind of, at least with SASE, I mean, maybe there are differences in ER positive or not, but certainly not like differences between hormonal therapy and triple negative, which obviously it doesn't work. But if dato does become an option, which seems like it's certainly not unlikely, I guess, we've seen that before. I'm curious how you see that profile. You know, currently, I don't know if you actually have that available in the UK, but in the US, we have the choice between those two. When you look at the tolerability profile of dato, what are some of the key things, and how does it actually play out? I'm particularly interested in your experience with mucositis.
Yeah, so it's as you said, they're very different drugs. They target the same target, they have the same class payload, but are very different drugs. With SG, it's neutropenia and diarrhea probably at the forefront. With data DXT, we think more of stomatitis and maybe a little bit of keratitis, although keratitis or dry eye has actually, with more experience, not been a big problem. Stomatitis, we're working on mitigation strategies, and our early experience with that is quite positive, but I'm sure we will learn more as we continue to use these drugs more. So we use we use prophylactic steroid mouthwash, but it also a magic mouthwash and ultimately optimal oral care is key. Avoiding localized infections, using optimal hygiene, using a soft toothbrush, using mouthwash, using oral steroids can reduce that incidence and severity of mucositis. We've also explored the use of ice chips during the infusion, which can again reduce some of the exposure. The consideration here is not to do it too short, because in contrast to chemotherapy, the half-life is a little bit longer. And therefore, that's why we see slightly mixed results. In some patients seems to be very good, in other patients slightly less. But I think I'm confident we will get better at managing this side effect as well, as we have managed to get better with managing fatigue or nausea with TDXT or diarrhea with SG.
Just want to compare notes to what I heard in the last couple of weeks from one of your colleagues, Dr. Erica Hamilton, about the mucositis. She really strongly emphasized the issue of preemptive preventing mucositis. She said once the mucositis is there, it's very difficult. Patients, according to her, they get started, they don't have mucositis, they stop using the mouthwash, they get into problems. I hadn't heard that before. Is that your experience?
So I would agree, start as early as possible. Prevention is always good. What's interesting, it's at the moment, it's not an easily predictable pattern. It's a small percentage of patients who get stomatitis, but in those patients, it can sometimes be slightly tricky to manage. And that's why it is key to start patients on early prevention, but also early intervention.
So I'm also curious about your approach to the HER2 low ER negative patient, and we could call them triple negative, I guess, but an ultra low, where I guess I don't think we really actually have data with hormone receptor ultra low, but I'm curious for practical purposes. And again, you know, particularly kind of putting aside, I don't know what kind of regulatory constraints might be there, but if you think about it purely from a, you know, what's good for the patient, how would you think through the issue of sequencing, you know, obviously, particularly the issue right now, sacituzumab versus TDXT, HER2 low and ultra low?
Yeah, there's ultimately no right or wrong in TNBC. But if I look at ASCENT, the trial is a more than 500 patient phase 3 trial just in TNBC, which has a substantial benefit in PFS and overall survival. Now, the TDXT data are based on just over 60 patients as a subgroup of the DESTINY-Breast04 trial. Those 60 patients are obviously have an impressive benefit that's totally consistent with the benefit of the rest of the trial. But the overall level of evidence is probably a little bit higher at the moment for SG in TNBC. And that's why my personal bias is at the moment I use for TNBC SG first and then TDXT later on. Whereas, for example, for your positive breast cancer, I do the other way around.
And I hear a lot of people saying that. Any difference if the patient is very symptomatic, you really need the response? You think SG and triple negative offers the same response rate as TDXT and HER2 low?
So from what we see, I would say Probably, yes. It's always difficult to cross-trial comparison, but the ASCENT trial, I think it's key to look at your control arm. The control arm was only 5% there, so it was a 7 times higher response with 35%. In the DESTINY-Breast04, patients were markedly less pre-treated than in ASCENT, and that's why the response rates possibly are higher, reaching almost to 50%. What is very clear, if you need to achieve a quick and high response, then an ADC seems to be better than chemotherapy, regardless whether we say Dato or T-DXd or SG.
You also showed some interesting data, kind of look like, you know, a sequence. It might be better to start with TROP2 or SASE and then go to T-DXd. When you showed the, I guess, comparative data, do you think there's any biology behind that? And you actually, do you even think it's real?
I'm not sure it's real. What I would say is we have one really good shot on goal with a topo 1 ADC. And one of the topics we haven't touched yet is target expression. When we look at the data, I didn't include this for SG. Of course, we know the higher the TROP2 expression, the higher the response. But the reason why we're not pre-selecting patients by TROP2 is because even with low TROP2 expression, SG was better than standard chemotherapy. And it's the same in HER2. If you look at HER2 high, the response rates are higher than in HER2 low. But it's still in HER2 low, T-DXd better than standard chemotherapy. Now, if you take what I say and say we have one really effective shot on goal, maybe in the future we need to be cleverer in the way we are selecting patients for their first ADC treatment. And if you have a patient with relatively high HER2 expression but very low TROP2 expression, and you know your first ADC is giving you the maximum benefit, maybe that's a patient where in the future we should think about T-DXd rather than SG and vice versa. But at the moment, this is all done based on gut feeling, and there's no clear rational be behind there how we select patients for that. I think ultimately your best ADC should go first where it has the best chances, and the second, but most of the resistance is driven by the payload. Your second ADC will always be inferior.
I was going to ask you about TROP2 assays and whether we just sort of have given up on trying to look at TROP2 assay results and efficacy. There was this assay reported at one of the lung meetings last year. I think it was actually for Dato, but again, it was a non-small cell lung cancer, some membrane. I don't know, they did it a different way. And there they did see, it looked like they could predict benefit. Do you think at some point we are going to be doing TROP2 assays or not going to happen?
I think that's almost a political question. Scientifically, I think it would make sense. And scientifically, the study I would love to see is that you have your standard treatment, which is an ADC, and we have a target expression selected ADC treatment, where you say high TROP2, you choose this, a high HER2, you choose that, high whatever HER3, you choose that. And my gut feeling would be, with a target selected or expression selected ADC treatment, we get a little bit further. But of course, these are studies that go across multiple compounds and are probably, as most of the studies, are not funded by universities or by research organizations, but more by the manufacturers, are probably studies that are not going to happen in that way. I would find it very interesting.
So I've got to compare notes on one other thing I asked Dr. Hamilton about in our discussion here about targets made me remember this, which is, I've heard people say about agents like Dato DXd, oh, it has a DXd payload, so we need to be concerned about interstitial lung disease. Mm-hmm. And I asked Dr. Hamilton, is that really true, or is the ILD that you see with T-DXd more related to more HER2 receptors in the lung? So I'm curious, like, do you think that other T-DXd, other payloads similar to T-DXd, like Dato DXd, have a high rate and same level of severity, or is there something different about a HER2 ADC and ILD?
I think it is very specific to an individual drug. Now, of course, an ILD is obviously, as we both know, is a mixed bag term. We have known for decades that with trastuzumab, we can see pneumonitis. As with many other cancer drugs, we can see pneumonitis with paclitaxel, we can see pneumonitis with everolimus, and we're just calling it ILD here. Now, it seems to be the combination of a HER2 antibody with a DXd payload that has that slightly higher rate of ILD, but we do see ILD with data DXd as well, but at a lower level. So it's not just the payload, it's the combination of payload and antibody.
So another thing that you mentioned in your presentation, I think it came up in one of your cases I thought was really interesting, was this issue of fatigue with ADCs. Mm. I think you were referring, there was a patient who's got sacituzumab. I don't know if it is a general thought you have about ADCs in general, but can you talk about your experience with fatigue when you have an ADC or sacituzumab, when it occurs, what people say to you? And you were saying that kind of there's a tachyphylaxis to it.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question where I'm not sure whether others have experienced the same, but I remember a number of patients where I gave them the first cycle of an ADC and they came back and said, "What have you done to me?" And so we say, okay, let's keep going. And with the second cycle, it got much better. And so I now often warn patients and say, you may feel more fatigue in your first cycle, but often, and I have no explanation why, but often it clinically seems to be better in a second cycle. And if not, then obviously we adjust the dose.
You think it's like a CNS effect?
I have absolutely no idea. And I would love to learn more about that. I would also obviously know whether that's just me who has experienced this or whether other people have seen this as well. But I've seen it in a fair number of patients that it gets better without dose reduction. But we do then reduce the dose if it doesn't get better.
Just out of curiosity, do you see more insomnia with ADCs?
So, I mean, insomnia is a difficult symptom again, and it's in breast cancer patients something we see very widely distributed. Starts with endocrine therapy, menopausal symptoms, but it also starts with when we give chemotherapy with the use of steroids. And so as we give effective triplet antiemetic therapy that usually contains a steroid and therefore difficulty with sleeping is very common, at least in the first 2 or 3 days after treatment. I haven't noticed that this is particularly bad with ADCs compared to chemotherapy. That isn't on my radar at the moment.
So we want to hear more about your thoughts about ASCENT-04, which, as you mentioned, was just presented this summer at the ASCO meeting. Can you talk about your global take on that? And, you know, putting aside regulatory issues, is that a strategy you would like to use now, or do you want to see more data?
So I'm obviously biased as I was part of that trial. I think it's a really important data set. But I also think it is worthwhile waiting until we have everything together. The what is for me really encouraging is that long duration of response is a 7 months delta. On the other hand, if you look at the second, third line data with ASCENT, we also got a quite significant delta there. And I think it is clear the combination works. It's clear we have a very high activity in a first line setting. But similarly to T-DXd in ER-positive breast cancer, I am at this point in time not convinced every single patient needs to have this drug right at the beginning. I think everyone needs to be offered sacituzumab govitecan over their course of disease, but in some patients it may be second or third line, in other patients it may be first line.
In those patients who do get it first line, either with an IO or sounds like maybe even without an IO after we see the new data coming out, how does that affect your thinking about further lines of therapy?
Well, that is the interesting question, is how well will patients respond to second, third, and fourth line treatment? And do we play one of our best cards at a time when we may not have to play it? Now, we can all both think of patients who have very aggressive disease and where we have this one shot on goal and where clearly an ADC and immune therapy may be the right strategy. But we can also think of patients with slightly more smoldering disease where as the cancer becomes more resistant, it's even more important to have an effective treatment. What I find really interesting, and again, if you divert from TNBC to ER-positive breast cancer and look at the differences in response rate in the first-line setting, second- or third-line setting, one thing that's a striking feature, actually across all programs, is how high the response rates are with ADCs. But they are the 40, 50, a little bit over 50% range, but they're not going to 80, 90% outside HER2-high disease. On the other hand, the response rates with chemotherapy, whether it's in ER-positive or in triple-negative breast cancer, in the first-line setting are still relatively good. But in the second- or third-line setting, normal chemotherapy doesn't work terribly well. So the delta between an ADC and standard chemotherapy is almost bigger in a second- or third-line setting where we have some early signs of resistance. We therefore need to learn, does this better response we have with an ADC if we give it early, does it allow us to treat patients longer and better, and does it lead to an overall survival benefit? Or is it in some patients better to use the more effective drug when we need it more?
Keeping on that theme of how prior therapy affects your decision-making, curious about prior use in the neoadjuvant and adjuvant setting of chemo and IO, how that affects treatment benefit in the metastatic setting, for example, in the ASCEND trial, and also time from neoadjuvant therapy to metastatic disease, how much of a factor that is.
Yeah, it's something we have always known for chemotherapy, that your pretreatment determines how you respond. If you look at back to the old taxane data, if you have at least 6 to 12 months from prior taxanes, you can re-challenge patients with taxanes. We haven't quite done that work with ADCs, and we certainly haven't done it properly with immune checkpoint inhibitors. It's for me, immune checkpoint inhibitors are transformative, and I don't think my role at the moment as a treating clinician is to find reasons not to give a drug. I try to find the reasons why I can give a drug that can possibly be transformative for patients. But I think as an academic community, we need to answer this and look into this. And in this context, I think it will be important then to also look at the backbone, because I think the higher activity of an ADC will be an immune enabler. So we need to break down this cancer with chemotherapy or an ADC to make immune therapy work and to bring immune cells in and release those tumor cell antigens. And I think the ADCs obviously have a higher response rate, as we just discussed. So I think even if we had done that work and say, what happens after chemo and immune therapy in the neoadjuvant setting, do you still give it in the metastatic setting? If you combine it with an ADC, it may be of slightly different biology, and therefore I would rather give immune checkpoint inhibitor too often than not often enough.
What's going on in terms of development of ADCs with non-chemo payloads? I'd heard that there's like immune payloads that are being looked at. Kind of reminds me a little of a bispecific in a way. But are we just using ADCs with chemo or looking at other payloads?
So there are, as you quite rightly said, there are immune payloads are being under investigation. There are also radioactive tracers there, which I think is a really powerful tool. And because ultimately, the way, as you know, I'm always very simplistic. The way I look at this is the antibody brings it there, and then we have to have something that kills the cell effectively. And chemotherapy does that well. Radiotherapy does that fantastically well and may not be cross-resistant to some of the things. Immune therapy could work, but it comes down to what mechanism we utilize. You mentioned bispecifics. Again, that's a really interesting area. And of course, there's a lot of interest and hope, for example, in the PD-L1 VEGF bispecifics. And you heard me mention bevacizumab as a drug, which is not very often used in the US. But there's clearly a potential of VEGF-targeting drugs and making tumors more immunogenic or more susceptible to immune therapy. And if you have this now in one molecule, I think some of the early data are really interesting, and I'm curious to see how this pans out in the bigger studies.
Yeah, when you were mentioning bevacizumab, I was kind of flashing back. I think it was at the 2005 ASCO meeting, it was actually in Orlando at that point, when the adjuvant trastuzumab trials were all presented. But there was also, I think, Kathy Miller was the one who presented the Bev study. And at that time, it was positive, but that was 20 years ago. And now, as you say, it's gone in the United States, but being used other places, including in Europe. What's the thinking in terms of the benefit of Bev?
So it's a difficult question, and I think there's a little bit of politics involved as well. Because if you think about it, you could probably give me names of 10 drugs that were approved based on a PFS benefit and not an OS benefit. And what we saw consistently with bevacizumab was a PFS benefit and a better response, but we did not see an overall survival benefit. And as a result, for reasons that I can't fully explain, it was in the US, it was decided not to continue with this drug, whereas in the rest of the world, many centers, hospitals, and countries said, actually, we have a better response, we have a longer progression-free survival. That clearly is something positive, even if patients may not live longer. So I think that's a unique situation, which is not just factual, but there's also possibly some health politics kicks in.
So a couple other related things that kind of popped into my mind, you know, kind of a little bit off of triple negative, but still the same basic principles. We were talking about bispecifics, and I'm getting ready right now to do a CME program next week on biliary tract cancer. Nowadays, we can do an entire program just on that. And one of the drugs there that's approved that's very interesting is zanidatamab, the anti-HER2 bispecific. So what do we know about that in breast cancer? And in general, again, this idea of, you know, lung cancer, they have, I think, amivantamab, same thing, hitting a receptor in 2 points. Any thoughts about Zani and also that kind of strategy in breast cancer?
Yeah, so combining or bringing in some of the immune effects is obviously particularly interesting when you treat with HER2 target agents. So I think these are for the right group of patients. Very interesting drugs. The challenge is always this is not a conventional targeted drug where you say this is my target, this is what I do, this is the target population. But we have to, for example, use this to enable a different antibody to work more effectively by activating the immune system around it. I think it's an interesting concept.
So again, slightly off of triple negative, but related to what we're talking about, we were talking about the idea, the possibility or maybe likelihood that Dato-DXd may become part of triple negative management. But as you mentioned, it's already with ER positive. I'm kind of curious how you think about this issue, or let's say theoretically, again, putting aside regulatory issues or access, how you think about Dato versus SASE in ER-positive disease.
Yeah, it's very difficult to do those head-to-head comparisons, isn't it? If you look at the actual trials, the Dato-DXd trial was in an earlier line than the sacituzumab govitecan trial. And there were, for example, no fourth line patients in there. So if you try to cross compare those data, then that is always unfair. And I think it's very difficult to do that. We can better compare the current performance of Dato-DXd with T-DXd, different target, but they were at least trials in a very similar patient cohort. And the T-DXd data I've always been very, very impressed with, whereas we also see a very clear signal in OS, which to date we haven't seen with Dato-DXd in ER-positive breast cancer. So I think for me at the moment, the front runner in ER-positive breast cancer is T-DXd personally as a first ADC. And then at the moment, a second ADC, yes, one can use Dato-DXd, but a lot of people feel a little bit more comfortable using even if it's the same class, still a slightly different payload, therefore would go from TDXT to SG. Now, I think that's a short term where we do this, because I will expect, and I expect other payload ADCs to come into that space, that we have better sequencing strategies.
So I can't sit down and talk to you and not bring up the issue of DB09, which was just presented at ASCO also. Curious about your thoughts, and again, about based on the data we have right now, is this a strategy you'd like to use, and how would you use it?
So it's, I mean, TDXT in HER2 high or HER2 positive breast cancer is almost a once in a generation drug, isn't it? We have seen activity there we hadn't seen in HER2 positive breast cancer before, and there are various ways we can look at this, and obviously the data are very impressive, and it's clearly a better strategy in a first line setting. But we can also come up with some caveats. And it's a relatively short follow-up. So my expectation is that the medians actually will get better, because the delta at the moment between the two arms is a little bit less than we thought. The TPH, so the control arm, clearly seems to have overperformed a little bit. I've never seen a study where this regimen had a 28 months progression-free survival, which is a little bit unusual. And that obviously makes that delta look less than it is. What I'm looking at is what also is missing in this trial is the strategy we adopted after Patina to give CDK4/6 inhibitors to those ER-positive patients who respond well. So all of that is sort of the long-winded explanation that I probably wouldn't use it yet in all patients. But for example, in ER-negative patients, aggressive disease, I think it's a fantastic strategy even now. I think we will have to see what is the OS benefit ultimately, because if we can achieve with TPH and then a CDK4/6 inhibitor and ER-positive breast cancer, already a good control of disease for 3.5 years, and now we can also with TDXT on average have an effective treatment for another 3 years, we will need to see how long and how effective are other treatments after TDXT. So there's no doubt that TDXT is the most effective treatment, but what do I do after TDXT? That I'm not entirely sure about. That's why I would wait a little bit before I say this is a strategy for all patients, and overall survival is obviously an additional important feature that will make our decisions easier.
When this all gets fleshed out, I guess maybe a couple years or who knows, longer, do you think pertuzumab still going to be there, or just TDXT alone?
It will be interesting to see. I'm not convinced that the pertuzumab will add as much as we think to this powerful ADC TDXT. But I may eat my words when the other comparison is going to be presented. I wouldn't be surprised if the data are not massively different. But let's see whether I'm wrong.
I second your prediction for what it's worth, but we'll see.
I always follow your lead.
Yeah, right. I guess another issue is, you know, again, if you get in a position where you're using TDXT up front and the patient's tolerating okay, are you going to use it indefinitely or stop and go to a maintenance strategy?
That is a really brilliant question. And there are academic studies ongoing. I think a lot of us feel it would be a fantastic induction treatment. And then you maintain with dual HER2 blocker, with trastuzumab pertuzumab, possibly then with a CDK4/6 inhibitor, or bring some of those novel agents in there. But these are studies, they're very difficult to do. And then it comes down to what level of evidence do we need. I think a lot of clinicians I talk to would love this as a strategy. But that's obviously not going to be an approved strategy. And doing a big phase 3 trial with such a concept will be very difficult to do.
Would you want to see a phase 3 trial before you added in Palbo or another CDK inhibitor, or you'd be okay doing it now?
So I think the situation in the US is slightly different to other parts of the world. We are always very limited in what we can do based on evidence. And so If you ask me, what do I feel is a great strategy, I would say it definitely is a great strategy induced with T-DXd, naming trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and endocrine treatment with CDK4/6 inhibitors maintenance treatment. But I won't be allowed to do that in our healthcare systems because I have got sufficient evidence for that. The other interesting question there would be, can we then re-challenge with T-DXd, which I would love to do? So you induce, you maintain, there's progression, you bring T-DXd back in, and I think that could work as well. That would be, from a patient perspective, very attractive, minimizing toxicity and keeping that efficacy.
Yep, they're doing that in prostate cancer, but that's another story. Yeah. Intermittent endocrine therapy, but yeah, that's a fascinating thought. This concludes our program. Special thanks to Professor Schmidt, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.